All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, speaking to you from the borough of Queens in New York City. It is the 22nd day of March, 2023. To start the show today, I'm here with Kimberly Ann. She's the founder and CEO of Lahontan Gold Corp. It's a company I just recently learned something about when I met up with Kimberly in Toronto. We'll be getting to Kimberly in just a minute or so. Before we get into today's show, we'd like to remind you that I am the editor of a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. And it focuses primarily on junior mining companies, like the one Kimberly's going to tell us about, gold and silver. And I think the time is coming, and the markets are really looking like it's time to start paying attention to the sector. And if you'd like to sign up for my letter, you can do that by going to miningstocks.com. And I want to thank each of you for listening and watching this show on YouTube. And if you have any comments, well, you can comment on YouTube, of course, but also you can send whatever comments, whatever you might want to say about this show to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions4taylor@gmail.com. The title of today's show is Why Bitcoin Isn't Money. And to understand that topic, at least the views of Keith Weiner, he will be with me in the second segment of today's show. But right now, I'm happy to tell you that Kimberly Ann is here, as you can see on the screen. She is the CEO and founder of Lahontan Gold Corp. Thank you so much for joining me, Kimberly.
Thank you. Appreciate being here.
Yeah, it's great to see you there in your Lake Tahoe digs. Very, very impressive. Kind of rustic in the middle of a snowstorm, I guess. So.
Absolutely.
Lots of snow. So, well, I think I've got you listed. Well, you trade in Canada under the symbol LG, and down here in the States, people can purchase it as I have, LGCXF, 121.3 million shares, selling at around 15 cents in US money. That would give it a market cap around $18 million. 1.7 million ounces of gold resource in a couple of different categories. So loads of upside exploration potential. The stock is selling very, very cheaply. So that's why I'm really happy to have you here. So let's get into the story. The Santa Fe, it's a former producing mine that you're working with. So it's not a brand new exploration story. And lots of already 1.7 million ounces. But as I understand it, lots of exploration potential. Can you talk about the history of this mine and how you picked it up for this company?
Absolutely. Yeah, so the Santa Fe asset was mined from 1988 to 1992 by Corona Gold. This was in the time of gold prices of $350, $400, you know, very hard time to make money. Yeah. Open pit style, four pits are on the property, historic pits. We were lucky enough to pick it up actually right before the pandemic started. I sold my last company, which is now C3 Metals, a copper gold asset in Peru. And John McConnell, the CEO of Victoria Gold, came to me and said, Kimberly, what are you doing next? I know you have projects in Nevada. Let's team up and start a company together. So we put a valuation around two of assets that I've ended in and one from the Victoria side. And we went to work. And to date, we've really done a lot of work. We put that together in September 2020. Mm-hmm. But from that time till now, we've raised over $15.5 million. We have done 15,000 meters of drilling, and we just put out our resources you are talking about, 1.7 million ounces of gold of 1.12 gold EQ. Very good grade for Nevada, the Walker Lane. And more importantly, it's a mine under closure. So really, we have, you know, big aspirations for this year. But what that means is we have a bond in place. We do quarterly monitoring on, you know, our wells. We have two wells on the property, a substation. So infrastructure galore. We think we can fast track it. So we're going to start our drill program in May, and we have lots of news flow coming out.
Yeah, I believe there's four exploration targets. Could you talk about those, where you might be focused most? And one question that comes to mind right away when you talk about a grade, an oxide, I believe these are mostly oxides, are they not, Kimberly?
That's correct, yes.
And so when we're talking about those kind of grades, I'm always wondering about stripping ratios. Do you have some sense of what the stripping ratio is? Because waste to ore, of course, factors into the economics.
Of course. Yes, that's a great question. So we do have four targets right now on the property. And the strip ratio project-wide is 2.13, so very low strip ratio. However, our Calvada slab complex during mining times was 0.7. So basically no strip ratio. Oh. So the idea when you bring it back into production, you start there first, and then you move over to the Santa Fe pit, do the layback, and then switch over to that area. They did have very good recoveries back in the day, 77% for the gold, 55% for silver. This was no optimization at all. Uh-huh. Our neighbor currently, Isabella Pearl mine, that's mined by 42 Gold, they're getting plus 80%. There's no reason why we can't be getting those kind of numbers. So, you know, we're just going to keep doing what we're doing. And I mean, the land package is 19 square kilometers. I mean, we did inherit 1,100 drill holes, 100,000 meters of drilling, but it's not even scratching the surface of what is there. So the mineral resource to date, 1 million of that is an oxide. 1.1 million is an indicated and 0.55 is an inferred. Our goal is to bring those over to the indicated side. And then we did this as a pit constrained model, which means we have a lot of blocks outside this model that we're really excited about drilling in between to bring those ounces into the project.
But the objective is really near surface oxides at this point. Is there any sense that this thing extends to depth? Is that something you look at? Is that something you might look at, or your focus is going to be primarily on proving up more near surface oxide ounces?
Well, I think the general market understand oxides a lot more than sulfides because they're heap leachable. They're easy to process. Over at our slab Calvada pits, we've drilled down to 280 meters. We haven't hit any transition material, all in oxide. The drilling to date from the past was like 100 meter holes because they were just looking for the next bench. Our holes, we've come in and drilled down to that 280 meters, but not enough of them. So that's a very exciting part of the story. If you look at our past history of our press releases since the inception of this company, you will see very, very high grade sulfides. So they're not to be ignored. But the idea is you stage it. You go in and you mine the oxides, and then when you get down to the sulfides, you're drifting in. So, I mean, it's a dream situation at very low cost to go to the sulfides. It's a good problem to have. Sure. What you're going to do with those in the future. But certainly right now, when we do an economic model of just what we have in the ground, I mean, we have a 7 to 8 year mine life right now before we drill another hole, a very good grades, very economic. And so we know what the next steps are to really get this to be in a robust state for, you know, for people to really pay attention.
So do you have your drill program laid out? Is it your geologists have established it for this year? And if so, do you have financing for it?
Yes, that's a great question. We do. I was just out in the field a couple of days ago. My home, I'm lucky enough to live 3 hours away from the project. So when I'm home, I go out and play with the rocks with my team. And we walked the whole property and picked our drill holes. We have the rig showing up May 1st. So I want to make sure That's all, intact. And what I like to do with my geologists is educate them on discount cash flow models, why I'm saying, hey, we need to find X amount of ounces over here, so that they understand where our dollars need to go.
Sure.
We did just close a financing. We raised 1.5 million. We ended up taking over 3 million because the interest was so high. We did stop it there because we don't want too much dilution right now. We want to, build up our share price, get more eyes on the story. And then, if we have to come back to the market later in the year, of course we will. But the drill rig shows up May 1st. I'm so excited to get out there and see it turning.
Well, you mentioned fast tracking, and I believe I saw something about a preliminary economic assessment. Might that be coming soon?
Oh, I wouldn't say soon, but what we are going to do is we're going to put out probably an updated resource number in November after this drill program when we get all the numbers back. So people see, okay, this is what we've gotten from this last drill program, the success of that. We'll look at those numbers and decide, okay, is the next step a PA or is the next step a drill program? And my concept of that is this time next year. We'll probably have the PEA out, but we'll still be drilling in parallel because that's just the first step for us. It's just showing the market that, here's the numbers, wrapping some economics around it. We're going to keep drilling. It's just such a huge land package that, you need to just keep going, really.
Well, it's really exciting. I know, another company I follow on my newsletter, I-80. I'm sure you know them. They're not
Oh,
too
yes.
far away from you.
Lovely friends.
And you know what they've done is they've drilled underneath old workings, old open pits. Very much reminds me of what you're doing. And my goodness, are they ever hitting some exciting things? So it's a, yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I'm so thankful I ran into you in Toronto, Kimberly, because I wasn't at all aware of what you were up to. I knew you a few years ago when you were working on another project, but this looks very exciting. Maybe in
Thank you.
closing, is there, I mean, we always like to know what investors should be watching out for. There's a lot of companies out there competing with yours. And why should people be paying special attention to yours? And what sort of news should they be on the lookout for going forward here in the next several months?
Yeah, that's a great question. Well, I mean, we do have an exciting drill program, as I mentioned, so you'll be seeing a lot of information coming from that. I will be on the road the next few months marketing to get this story out there. But I will always say to the public, it's not just about being a small junior company. We can backstop it by building our mines if we want to. We have great partners, board members that have built mines. I've built two mines with my business partner. So we have the team to go the distance, but we always work for our shareholders and we'll just see how that plays out. But this is really an exciting company because it's clean, there's no debt. We're just gonna, get that drill bit going. And through organic growth, I think people are gonna see what's gonna happen. And I just can't be more excited about a company.
Yeah, well, you've had a lot of success in the past, and that's one thing I failed to notice when I introduced you, but it's true. So this is really an exciting story. And I might say that the fact that you have the team to take it further along the way gives you some leverage too, perhaps. The big guys
Absolutely.
can't just stay back and say, well, you just wait till these guys give up. And so, well, it's
Yeah.
really great to have you, Kimberly. Thank you so much for your time, and we'll look to keep up with this story going forward.
Thank you. Great to see you, Jay. Take
All
care.
right, you too. All right, folks. Well, don't go away because just in a moment, Keith Weiner will be with us to tell us, well, to explain at least from his point of view, why Bitcoin isn't money. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Keith Weiner. Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm really happy to be with Keith Weiner. He's the founder of Monetary Metals. He's with me once again. We've had Keith on a couple of times in the past when it was just a radio show before we went on YouTube. Thank you, Keith. Thank you so much for joining me again.
Thanks for having me.
I think I saw a quote recently in 1912 in a congressional testimony. JP Morgan said, "Gold is money, everything else is credit." I assume you agree with that. Maybe comment on that comment.
I do. And it was what, 40 odd years prior to that, that Karl Menger, the founder of the Austrian school, I don't think he necessarily had pretensions that that's what he was doing at the time, defined money as the most marketable good or the most marketable commodity. And so when you have a dollar, which in those days, or dollar bill, excuse me, dollar was actually defined as a amount of gold, a weight of gold, X number of grains. But when you have a piece of paper that is redeemable in gold, it's basically a promise to pay gold. Nobody in those days would have confused, on the one hand, the promise to pay the gold. This is not a dollar bill, it's my business card, with the gold bar itself. And this is not a gold bar, it's my phone. Nobody would have confused those two things. Like confusing, if you go to a fancy restaurant and you check your coat and they give you a little coat check receipt, nobody would confuse the coat check receipt with the coat. Only one of those two things will keep you warm when it's raining and cold outside, and not the piece of paper. And by 1912, Congress was hell-bent on establishing the Federal Reserve. And in order to do that, they have to get away with certain, forcing off certain confusions. And one of those is the difference between money and credit. Today, that confusion reigns so supreme that I almost find it amusing standing off to the side with all the debates over what the proper definition of the money supply is. Because you have M0, M1, M2, M3, MZM, true money supply, TMS, AMS. And the thing that, when you're clear on that money is gold and everything else is credit, you realize the difference. What's the difference between a dollar bill and a 30-year treasury bond duration? They're both credit. They're issued by the government, different arms of the government. And there really is no fundamental line to be drawn, which is why everyone is spending so much time debating drawing the line here versus there. And at the end of the day, there's no money in the monetary system. That was Nixon's legacy. They banished money, right? You can own gold after 1975, but it's not in the monetary system anymore. It's like you have the monetary system over here and you have gold over here, and people can exchange paper for gold at whatever the current market price is, but that's not what that's all it's about, certainly not in 1912.
Well, what is so unique about gold that the markets have chosen gold whenever they're free to do so? I think throughout history, most of the time, at least since the Roman days, or before that, at biblical days even.
Yeah, I was going to say it goes back. Gold was precious to the ancient Egyptians. I think that's a few thousand years BC. I may be slightly wrong in my history there. And initially, I think they regarded it so precious, they didn't want to let the common people have it. It was really only for the priesthood and the temples. And then, of course, the cat got out of the bag. You had theft, you had bribes, you had whatever going on. And there's a certain point at, and of course, you have gold, coming out of the mines. And there's a certain point at which everybody has gold, and that's it. What makes gold unique? So I wrote an article for Forbes back in, I don't know, 2012 or 2013. And the question was, why gold makes the best money and nothing else comes close? Something like that was the title. And I was looking at this idea. Suppose you had a village, let's say on the delta of a river. There's good fishing and there's good hunting and whatever. And they're just rising out of subsistence. So when you're at the true subsistence level, there's no trade because nobody produces a surplus. You eat only what you hunt. There's nothing left over. There's no possibility of trade, really. But you start to produce a little bit of a surplus and suddenly people have things to trade. And so I asked the rhetorical question, suppose you have this guy who produces leather moccasins. So he's buying the deer skins from the hunter, produces leather moccasins, and he's hungry. So he goes to a fisherman and says, I'll trade you this nice new pair of leather moccasins for whatever, six fish. And that's a great deal. And they both are very happy with it. Of course, the next day, the moccasin maker is hungry again, but the fisherman still has his one day old, still basically new leather moccasins. So when the leather moccasin guy comes back, the fisherman's like, no, nah, man, I'm all good. They'll come back in a year when these are worn out. And so, you know, the moccasin maker has a very big problem. Actually, the whole society is a problem, but it's most obviously manifest on the moccasin maker. So, you know, what do? So the moccasin maker is looking for some intermediate good that he can sell his moccasins for that he knows that the fishermen might take. Mm-hmm. And throughout history, there were different goods that were used. Salt comes to mind.
Yeah.
Wheat comes to mind. But each good that you want to trade into when you sell your, let's say, moccasins in this case, and then you trade out of that good to get the thing you really want, which is food for dinner, every good that you can use has losses that you will suffer. Because when you go to buy that good, and I did not use the term bid and offer and spread in this article, because I was mm-hmm. really trying to keep it short and for a very lay audience, but you're paying the offer price when you buy into the good, when you get paid the bid price when you're dumping that good to get something else.
Right.
And so every good has a different degree of marketability.
Mm-hmm.
It's a measure essentially of the bid-ask spread, or the inverse of the bid-ask spread. So the more marketable good has a thinner spread. And that's the loss you take if you're trading in and out of it.
Yeah.
And so you have a very powerful incentive to find the most efficient good that has the least loss.
Mm-hmm.
And gold is that good by far.
Uh-huh.
It, you know, you can see why, because it's not perishable, and because it doesn't even tarnish, and because it's divisible down to the smallest thing, the smallest speck of gold is the same as any other speck of gold. And it's recombinable, right? A rock wouldn't work, because if you split it in two, you can't combine the rocks back together again. And it has a certain degree of scarcity, although gold's a lot less scarce than I think a lot of people assume, but not so scarce. Unobtainium, if there were such a thing, wouldn't really work as money, because there needs to be enough of it around that everybody can participate in it. Unobtainium would have a very wide bid-ask spread. So it has a unique set of chemical, physical properties, logistical, like it's scarce, but not that scarce. And then the economic property is because it's so desirable. Now, in ancient Egypt, it was very desirable because they worshiped the sun, and gold is the only metal of that color.
Yeah.
Copper sort of arguably, you know, leans in that direction. Uranium maybe a little bit, but, you know, gold is a bright yellow. And there's nothing else like it. It's shiny, reflects the sunlight really well. And for whatever reasons, you know, even today, if you, I notice when I'm in the audience, but also when I'm a speaker, if the speaker holds up a gold coin and is talking about it and kind of waving it about a bit, you know, the audience sort of leans in. It's exciting. There's something about wanting to hold that gold coin. And for anybody watching this who's never held one, I encourage you to go get one and hold it. There's an emotional connection to it. And, yeah. You know, let's face it.
Yeah.
And it's very, very heavy. It's much heavier, much, much, much heavier than it has any right to be. I think gold is about twice the density as lead, something yeah. like that. You know, three times that of iron. I mean, it's really heavy. So it has a tangible reality to it that any other metal feels cheap, you know, by comparison. And so people value it. But because everybody values it universally, it has a really narrow spread. It makes really good money because you don't take losses, or not very much losses, to get in and out of gold versus any other good that you could possibly name.
Right. So silver, I've always thought of as the second best money, monetary metal anyway, but it's a lot more volatile. I mean, one of the attributes of gold is, as you said, it retains its value. It doesn't have this volatility that silver has. Copper has also been used in money to a certain extent. I guess you've gone over the attributes of gold. You've pretty much answered why they may be inferior forms of monetary metals, but any comment?
I would add that silver is actually superior in one specific context.
Okay.
That is, it is the most marketable in the kind of quantities that someone who's working for wages as a skilled tradesman, if he wants to put 10% of his weekly wages into you know, savings, into metal, you know, what is $50 or $100 worth of metal look like if it's gold? Well, if it's gold, it's a tiny fraction of an ounce.
Mm-hmm.
And because you're getting into tiny fractions, the fabrication cost eats you alive.
Yeah.
Much, much wider spreads. If you're talking a gram of gold, much wider spreads than on a 1 ounce, you know, bar, let's say.
Yeah.
And then number two, it's just not very satisfying. Have you ever seen one of those Perth Mint 1 gram things in a Certi card? So it's a little thing the size of a plastic credit card with a little clear plastic window in it. Inside that window floats this little fleck. I call it a bar, but I think that's making a mountain out of a molehill. It's not very satisfying. You know, if you got 50 or 100 bucks worth of silver, you got a small handful of coinage.
Yeah.
And there's less losses. Again, the bid-ask spread on that amount of silver would be less, certainly historically, than the bid-ask spread on the same value worth of gold. And so silver was actually better in that context, which is why gold didn't beat it out, you know, entirely the way it did, you know, every other, you say copper, again, wheat, salt, cattle. Mm-hmm. Gold beats all those things out at some point in history, and then they never, nobody ever thinks of those things in any monetary sense anymore. We have the word salary. We have the old ancient expressions, he's worth his weight in salt,
yeah,
kind of thing. But we don't really think of salt as a monetary thing anymore. But silver survived for that reason, and to this day survives for that reason.
Well, I think the advice of people, if you haven't held an ounce of gold, you should do so. A lot of Americans, if not most Americans, have never done that. And we've been, there was some experiment, I can't remember what it was. Somebody on television was goofing around with people, and they held up a gold coin and compared to something else that was relatively had relatively little value. And the people on the street would select a thing of little value. I mean, they didn't seem to realize that gold had value. And we've been taught that gold doesn't have value in America, I think. And other parts of the world, I guess they're not quite as smart as we are, because they seem to be accumulating. The Chinese and the Russians are accumulating gold like mad right now, it seems, while our propagandists are trying to say, you don't want to own that stuff.
I saw that video. It was like the Center for Western Center for Journalism or something like that. I forget what that guy's name is. I want to say something Dice. Did this video where he's like saying, here's a Starbucks cup of Starbucks coffee and here's a gold coin, and which would you take? I kind of suspect that was, shall we say, highly cherry picked. That, you know, he was there all afternoon, and there were people who opted for the gold coin, and they didn't make the video.
Okay, well, maybe that's it. Maybe that's it.
I do think, as an American, I think I have the right to say this, and I've traveled pretty extensively around the world. I think we Americans understand gold least by far.
Yeah.
And it's because we're in such a fortunate position. We've never had a currency collapse or a serious currency crisis. I mean, Americans, you know, my age and older, remember the 1970s and how crazy the inflation was. But you go anywhere in Asia, let alone sub-Saharan Africa, let alone Latin America, but even in Europe, and you say, oh yeah, you know, we had inflation and the official CPI was, you know, 12% or whatever it was in 1979, and maybe it was actually running a bit hotter than that. And they'd say, oh yeah, 15% inflation, 20%. You think that's a crisis? That's cute. You know, because they'll have that in a month. And, you know, every 5 or 10 years in Argentina, the currency is a yo-yo and it does that.
Right.
We've never had anything like that. So Americans are very trusting in the dollar because we've been very fortunate. And so they've just completely kicked gold, you know, to the curb. And they just regard that as you know, either just sort of a fool's errand. Or obviously the Bitcoiners, the millennials say, oh, okay, boomer, you know, enjoy your shiny rock.
Yeah.
I say that to me, they're actually wrong on two counts. One, as I'm not a boomer, I'm a proud member of Generation X. And number two, gold's not a rock, it's a metal.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, it doesn't matter.
Well, I mean, certainly there are a growing number of people in America that are concerned about our current financial situation, and the recent turmoil in the markets have a lot of people running off to Bitcoin as if that's money. I mean, the dollar doesn't have any of the attributes that you named gold has. I don't think that, well, what about Bitcoin? You know, I've read enough of your material, Keith, to know that you're not a big fan of Bitcoin. And so, I mean, there's somebody named Hal Finney who suggested that the Bitcoin could rise to $10 million of Bitcoin. And I'm wondering, well, okay, but what's the dollar going to be worth if that's the case? And if your Bitcoin is worth $10 million, but the dollar isn't worth anything. What is the Bitcoin worth? I don't know if that's your line of thinking, but because I think you've been more of a deflationist than an inflationist. You're known as a fan of the dollar milkshake theory and all of that, and I believe there's validity there as well. $10 million of Bitcoin, and people are running off. I mean, we've seen almost a 45 or 50% swing from November till just recently in the price of Bitcoin. I mean, that's crazy. I guess that's one of the reasons you would say Bitcoin is not a good money, because how can you plan your life around something that has that kind of volatility?
So I would say it isn't money at all, because it's just a number in a database maintained by the miners. And they say, well, you know, you have self-custody. Well, not exactly. You have a password that, you know, unlocks that record in somebody else's database. You know, the reason why money has to be a physical thing, we're physical beings. We live in a physical world.
Yeah.
And at the time, not everybody and not every day of the year, there's a time in which nothing else will do other than to take your marbles and leave the sandbox.
Yeah.
You don't. You know, you're not comfortable with the risk in the system. You don't trust the counterparty. There's great technological disruption going on, something. And you don't really want to continue to take a flyer and ride the system.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, with Bitcoin, there's no way to get out of it. You're on the Bitcoin ledger, and that's what it is to have a Bitcoin, is to be, I argue, a liability on the Bitcoin ledger. And the problem with it is there's no asset on the other side. There's only a ledger of liabilities. But you know, going deeper into it, the first thing I think needs to be said is are we talking about which makes the better speculation to make more dollars in the short term, gold or Bitcoin, versus are we talking about any kind of monetary theory for either what makes money in an academic sense, or what should we be striving to from a policy perspective to restore some sanity to financial system and financial markets?
Right.
And if the question is the former, right, I think there are certain folks that, you know, in the gold community that get too caught up in saying gold's going to go up more than Bitcoin. And whenever Bitcoin is going down, those people are triumphant and they're, yeah, you know, see, we're right. And
yeah.
Then Bitcoin skyrockets, you know, 300% in a year, then those people are sort of, cowed and they're gazing their nasal. And, you know, the Bitcoiners are like, see, you idiot, you boomers with your stupid shiny rock. And, to which I always said, look, it's obvious that Bitcoin is superior at skyrocketing, also crashing.
Yes.
And also crashing. So if your goal is to find something that is going to skyrocket the most, you shouldn't be looking at gold. Gold, that's not what gold does.
Yeah.
Like the people who say you can't eat gold. If you're looking for food, you're not looking at gold. That's not what gold does. It's not food. Okay. Neither is a dollar bill, of course. So if you're looking for something to speculate on, Bitcoin makes a much better speculation if you are nimble and agile and you're right about which direction it's going to gyrate next. It's
right.
Unstable. And if you get the timing right, you can make a fortune. Absolutely. You can also lose a fortune. And you know, people have done both. You know, I wrote a lot of Bitcoin articles back in a couple in 2013 and then a lot in 2017 while it was skyrocketing. I prefer to kick it when it's actually skyrocketing rather than when it's crashing.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't get accused of, oh, you're just kicking it when it's down. And I think I'd said something like, well, its value is arbitrary. I mean, it could be a penny and it could be $1 million or anywhere in between, and probably will be. I just said that over and over. Like, I don't know if it's going to be $10 million or not, maybe. Mm-hmm. I mean, if the crowd gets mad enough, the madness of crowds could drive it to $10 million, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe not. I wouldn't bet on it. I wouldn't necessarily bet against it, but I wouldn't bet on it either.
Yeah.
But the problem is it doesn't work. So it's not money because it isn't a physical thing. It doesn't work in any kind of finance context. The Bitcoiners always say Bitcoin is disrupting finance.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, finance means the raising of capital to increase, you know, to pay for increased production.
Right.
If you have the opportunity to buy a large ship full of iron ore, and immediately, it's simultaneously, it's going to be a hedge transaction, sell it to the smelter, whether that smelter is in Korea, China, or wherever, you're making a little spread. And basically, you're getting paid for the interest rate plus the shipping and the risk and the cost and whatever. So you go to borrow money to put that transaction on. If you were to borrow Let's say that's $1 million worth of iron ore, but instead you borrowed $1 million worth of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
What is that at today's prices? 35, 36 Bitcoin or something like that. I'm doing the math in my head. And by the time the ship gets to the smelter, it turns out you actually owe $2 million worth of Bitcoin back. I mean, you'd be bankrupt. You'd be ruined.
Yeah.
Nobody can finance a farm, a mine, a trading house, a shipping, a factory, a retail, a restaurant. You can't finance those things in Bitcoin. So when they say, well, Bitcoin is disrupting finance, they just mean that it's become the most interesting speculation. It's the most interesting bubble for especially the younger generation to go pile into. And they somehow think that's finance. So we've confused the paper that is promised to pay gold. We've confused the Kochek receipt for the coat. We've now confused the speculation on a bubble with finance.
Right.
And they say, well, it's disrupting finance. No, it isn't. Nobody can finance anything in the real world in Bitcoin because it's too unstable. Right. The very Bitcoin promoters who say Bitcoin's going to be $1 million, $10 million. What does Michael Saylor say? I think he has an even higher number than that, doesn't he? Although he doesn't seem to be on as many interviews anymore now that he's made a mess of his company. But, you know, whatever the number is, these are the proponents telling you, no, right. But it's unborrowable for this reason.
Right.
And so it's going to forever remain, here's a real world of financing real things, and here's a world of Bitcoin, and they will never be connected because it's unstable.
Right. So that's why Bitcoin isn't money. And of course, you know, one of the things people always argued against gold has been that gold doesn't provide any interest. Well, Keith, you and your monetary metals are proving that's not true. People can invest their gold and get a decent return, a safe return, getting paid back in gold or silver too. I believe you also handle silver. So that means there, because gold is stable, you can do that, but you couldn't do that with Bitcoin because of the volatility. Nobody can use it as an investment, as a medium of exchange, or as a means of investing. So I guess
medium of exchange. You know, they like to point out merchants accept as medium of exchange. Well, most merchants today are running on 5% margins. I mean, it's a pretty tight business.
Yeah.
Imagine let's say you're selling TVs, you know, big flat screen TVs. So price is $1,000. You accept $1,000 worth of Bitcoin. What is that? 1/28th of a Bitcoin, whatever that works out to, 0.03 something, I guess.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you hold that for a few days and then you have to pay your distributor, your wholesaler. Imagine if during that time the price fell from $28,000 to $21,000. So your $1,000 worth of Bitcoin is now, whatever, $650 worth of Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it could happen. In fact, it's happened many times.
Yeah.
You'd be bankrupt again. So whenever it appears that merchants are accepting Bitcoins and needing to exchange, they're actually not. Mm-hmm. They're hiring a third-party currency exchange via an API. So they need dollars, and they set their price in dollars. The third-party currency exchange is plugged into the price, and they know that that's 0.037 Bitcoin, although they mark it up to 0.038 so they can make a fee. And if somebody wants to buy that TV for 0.038 Bitcoin, the exchange finds a fourth party who wants to buy Bitcoin who has dollars in his hands. And they broker this complex multi-party swap where the guy who wants to buy the Bitcoins gets a Bitcoin, gives up the dollars. The merchant wants the dollars, gives up the TV. The buyer gives up the Bitcoin, gets the TV. And the third-party currency exchange that brokers it gets their 0.01 Bitcoin for brokering the transaction. And that's a complicated, you know, four-party multi, you know, swap.
Sure.
And then the Bitcoiners say, see, Bitcoin is a medium of exchange. Well, not exactly.
Uh-huh.
Like with all their claims. Well, that's not exactly true the way you stated it. But of course, the merchant could never take the Bitcoin onto the balance sheet because they're risking bankruptcy if they do that.
Yeah. Right. Well, Keith, you see a potential for something like Bitcoin, which does have a limitation on the amount of the quantity of Bitcoins that can be created. And it gets more and more expensive the more that are being created. And it gets to another question I want to ask you about in a minute. But do you see the possibility ever of something like Bitcoin being backed by gold so you could have, you know, a gold Bitcoin? Is that something that could happen?
I certainly think somebody could create a cryptocurrency token. In fact, there are a number of companies who've done exactly that, that are redeemable in gold. You buy them with dollars, or I suppose you could turn over your gold coin as these tokens. And then at the end, you have the right to redeem it. Bitcoin itself, I mean, it is what it is. It's irredeemable. I don't see how you could tie Bitcoin to gold per se, but you could create a blockchain-based cryptocurrency that was gold redeemable. And that's probably the future. I mean, when we have any kind of gold standard and gold is circulating again, I don't really think people are going to have little leather purses tied to their belt, jingling with coins when they go to buy stuff in the grocery store, go to buy a Starbucks. I don't think they're going to be pulling out little precious metal coins.
No.
You know, it's going to be, you know, you take your phone or even your wristwatch and you scan it and it goes deep, right? I mean, that's the future of technology. Yeah. But there will be a gold debit, you know, behind that.
Right. Tiny little fraction of a gram to buy your...
And it'll all be handled electronically. The gold one, you know, will still sit right in the vault, but the right owner, the name of the owner will change.
So you see that as a possibility and a likelihood in the future even, huh?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, interesting. Are you concerned, though, about the, you know, central bank digital currencies and what that might mean for our liberty? Because I think you are... a libertarian, Keith. You're a person that treasures the idea to speak freely and to act freely and to, you know, conduct commerce freely.
I shoot my mouth off plenty. I say lots of things that if we lived in the kind of dictatorship that doesn't allow that, I would be off to the gulag, you know, years ago.
For
the
show. You and me as well, I'm afraid.
That's right.
But it is of concern, obviously, to you, and it's something that I don't know if it's stoppable. That's what I don't know. If there's any, you know, can it be stopped even?
I think so. Absolutely, central bank digital currencies make it easier for them to control you, even tighter. I mean, people have raised the scenarios of, hey, you know, you look like you're a little overweight. We're not going to let you make that transaction to buy that Coke right now. And all that kind of stuff. And also social credit score.
Right. So
China, it was, you know, you have to have a good social credit score to get on an airplane, do all kinds of things.
Right. It's true in China.
They have some star athlete. This is a couple of years. This is pre-COVID. Some star athlete had a poor social credit score because he said some things that the party didn't like. And so to make it, was it the Olympics? It was something that all the other people are taking planes and they're taking these 300-mile-an-hour trains that China has. And this guy had to take this creaky old train that had 172 stops and took him, you know, 2 days to get there. Of course, you know, his athletic performance is reduced because he's tired and frustrated.
Sure.
And whatever. But I think, and of course, that's all true. And that's all intrinsic to a central bank digital currency. I would point out that they have largely have that infrastructure to control people right now, even through the conventional banking system. Mm-hmm. Banks are not merely regulated, they're supervised.
Yeah.
This also comes up in the context of Silicon Valley Bank. And some people say, well, SVB was really stupid. I'm not sure that's a full explanation. So banks are supervised, which means they have to house government agents in their offices
right at
the expense of the bank. And these government agents have the right to snoop through the files, invite themselves to meetings, and issue commands. So if monetary policy says we want you buying bonds because we're trying to do QE and lower the interest rate,
right,
the supervisor tells the bank to buy the bonds. Is the bank stupid for obeying the order? Well, you don't get to disobey the order. That's just not how it works. So they already have this infrastructure. But I think what really drives central bank digital currencies is negative interest rates.
Yeah.
Which we've not had in the U.S. yet. But Switzerland has had it the worst. And I've got friends in Switzerland who own a vault. It's one of those ancient mountain caves that the Swiss were using in World War II. They're hiding the gold, they're hiding munitions. And then anyway, you know, in peacetime, the government sold all that stuff off. These guys bought it, put in modern electronic security systems and climate control. They store artwork there, they store precious metals, all kinds of things. And they've had any number of customers. So in Switzerland for a long time, the deposit rate for large deposits was negative. 0.75% per annum, 75 basis points. Not for retail. So if you're a retail person and you have 20,000 franc in a bank, it was zero. But for corporate and institutional accounts, it was negative. And they have some customers who brought like 18 wheelers with pallets full of franc notes to store in the vault. So, and you think about the cost and inconvenience of that, and of course the risks.
Yeah.
The bank account, that at negative 75 basis points, the interest rate was just barely enough to make them actually pull their cash out of the banking system. So I look at this and say, okay, suppose the interest rate was minus 1%. Suppose it was minus 1.25, 1.5, 2. Where is it that you get a mass run of everybody pulling their paper cash out? Yeah. That's a run on the banks that would destroy the banking system,
sure,
just like Silicon Valley Bank. So if you're anticipating negative interest rates, which I do, I'm in the deflation camp.
Yes.
Negative interest rates are coming. You have to build all of the infrastructure for that. And if people have a way to flee to paper, which is, of course, zero interest, you have to take that away and force them to use a central bank digital currency cash, because the key feature is it can be, you can impose the same negative interest rate on cash as you do in a deposit account. And therefore, there's no reason to reject the deposit account in favor of cash. Both of them have the same negative yield. You're not getting any savings there. People won't bother. And that's how you preserve the banking system. And of course, it comes with all the other ancillary benefits of control and surveillance and social credit scores and all the rest of that too,
right,
which is just from their perspective, bonus.
Right, right. No, it's certainly of great concern, I think. But all right, well, you say you're a deflationist. I know you've been known as a deflationist, and so that doesn't surprise me at all. I had wanted to talk to you a little earlier in the year, right after you had written your outlook for 2023. But you know, we, for one reason or another, we weren't able to get in touch with each other for this conversation. We've had a lot of water under the bridge, running very rapidly the last few weeks, the last few couple of trading sessions, actually. What's your outlook now? What are you seeing? Interest rates? We've seen pretty much the peak in interest rates. Do you think inflation is going to be subdued soon? As a deflationist, I would imagine you see the aggressive interest rate hikes is likely to send this economy reeling downwards pretty soon.
So a couple of comments. The first is that there are many harmful effects of falling interest rates. But if one only had a single concern, and that is consumer prices, one should want a falling interest rate structure rather than rising interest rates.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is with each, so the interest rate is the cost of capital to finance production. With each downtick in interest rates is an increased incentive to go and increase production. Suppose you are a restaurateur. Suppose you have 175 hamburger restaurants in a chain across, I don't know, the Southwest from Washington State, Oregon, California, Nevada, Arizona, New Mexico. And you always have a spreadsheet that you're looking at, which is to open the next marginal store. And the reason why you haven't is because that spreadsheet is red ink. It says if you open that store, it's going to be, you know, a loss.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Fed comes along and lowers the interest rate. And now with a new lower interest rate, you plug in a lower cost of capital, that spreadsheet goes from red to black ink.
Right.
And so the same thing is true for the makers of hamburger grill equipment. Same thing is true for the makers of the plate glass that you use in the storefronts for restaurants. The same thing is true for the farmers and the trucking companies and the refrigerator manufacturers. Everybody has a marginal increase in incentive to increase production.
Mm-hmm.
So if you want lower consumer prices, you should want lower interest rates, not higher.
Mm-hmm.
What happens if you jack up interest rates as they've done is initially, of course, you kill certain markets dead. So, you know, the housing market, nobody can afford today's house prices with the mortgage rates that you have now versus before. So that seizes up, which means the distributors that are selling, let's say, bricks or cinder blocks, you know, suddenly that dries up. And they already have inventory in stock. They have to dump that inventory, even if it means at a loss, because they have a cost of carry, which, by the way, the cost of carry has just gone up with the interest rate. So initially, you see this drop in prices as inventory that's in the system has to work its way through. And for that matter, you have excess capacity. Right now, you have all these cinder block manufacturers that have already made the investment in their cinder block plants. And in some cases, it makes sense to operate at a small loss rather than to shut down and take a much bigger loss. And you just operate at a small loss and hope for better times. So you continue to get production for some time, even though rates have gone up. But if you hold the rates high and keep raising them for long enough, one by one, those distributors, those cinder block companies go out of business. At the end of the day, the return on capital has to be greater than the cost of capital. And if you keep hiking the cost of capital, necessarily the return on capital has to go up. And the only way that can go up is by bankrupting all the producers until the remaining few producers, the supply is so reduced that now the few suppliers who are left can get a price high enough to get a return on capital above the return on above the cost of capital. They're actually we Monetary Metals, we put out a cartoon showing Jay Powell driving a gasoline truck, and there's a the economy is on fire labeled inflation, and there's barrels of oil and all sorts of things, and there's this huge blaze, and he's spraying gasoline onto it, and there's a reporter saying, "Do you think that'll be enough to deal with the fire?" It's like they've got the mechanism exactly backwards. It reminds me of there was a space shuttle launch that was aborted because they had programmed in negative gravity for the moon. That in this particular bug, the moon was repulsive rather than attractive. Like you got the sign wrong on gravity. That's the mainstream theory. So leaving that aside, what I said in 2015 when they were hiking rates, what I said a year ago is if they're going to attempt to hike rates, they can't really push them up very far or get away with it for very long without precipitating the sort of crisis that they don't want to precipitate. And this is not me saying, well, you should have lower interest rates because it's better. This is me saying you have a choice of two evils, but I don't think they're going to want this evil. They'd rather have the sort of slow destruction of the whole system rather than the mass blow up of the whole system. So falling interest rates, we die slowly. You blow it all up, we die much quicker. And so you precipitate a banking crisis. And so, but it's a political, it's an unpredictable, ultimately, it's a political decision as to whether or not they want to do it. And sometimes politics makes for very strange, bedfellows. I remember the Tax Cut Act of 2017. You had the right saying, we don't want deductibility of state and local taxes. It was a very sort of unique, localized political issue that suddenly had the right flipping on that particular issue at that time. Now you have a bailout with Silicon Valley Bank. The hard right and the hard left both agree there shouldn't be a bailout, but for opposite reasons. The hard right is saying this is a bunch of woke, diversity, equity, inclusion, politically correct people, let them sink for that reason. And the left is saying it's a bunch of privileged white boys, rich white boys, let them sink for that reason. And so you get weird politics. And could the politics continue to push the Fed to hike rates? I can't say that's not my swim lane. But what I can say is they're precipitating a hell of a crisis. And if they let it go into full bloom, this crisis will be worse than 2008, which is pretty bad. So what are they going to do? Well, they already have given us one hint. And I'm a big believer, people say that history doesn't rhyme, but it repeats. And one of the things that rhymes, but not repeating exactly, is the policymakers take a very similar course, but they give it a new name and they do it in a slightly different way, and people don't catch on as fast. And so one thing that they've done is they've said to the banks, okay, banks, you guys are all screwed because you had a huge inrush of cash deposits in 2020 when interest rates were at record lows, which means when long-dated bonds were at record high prices. Their bond price and interest rate or a seesaw. So if you bought a 10-year treasury in August of 2020 and you sold it just before Silicon Valley Bank collapsed, you would have taken a 20% loss. I mean, that's huge. So here's what we're going to do for you banks. We're going to allow you to, we're going to give you loans with your long-dated treasury bonds as collateral, but we're going to value that collateral at the price you paid for it way back in 2020 rather than today. So they didn't use the word repo, but this is repo. It's a purchase repurchase agreement. The Fed is effectively buying that bond off of them, but not at today's high interest rates. They're buying it off of them at the 0.57% interest rate that prevailed in August of 2020. And so this is kind of one hand is saying quantitative tightening, The yeah. Fed take a thing away, but under the table it's not exactly quantitative easing, and I can see that there are some differences. And I know that various prominent voices, Daniel DiMartino Booth, I think, is arguing with Brent Johnson over this right now that it's not a quantitative easing.
Yes.
But it's a Fed bond repo buying lending program at much higher bond prices.
Yeah.
It's buying at the bond prices back in those days, but it's lending and it's full recourse lending, meaning the Fed can go after the banks in theory if they don't change the rules mid-game, which they probably will. And so is that quantitative easing? Well, not exactly, but it rhymes. So it's the Fed lending to the banks, buying these assets off the bank's balance sheets at much lower interest rates, which almost creates a situation where there's one interest rate for thee and another interest rate for me and my cronies.
Yeah.
Well, where the banks are able to sell these bonds as if the interest rate was under 1%.
Yeah. It's a mess.
But they have to do these things, otherwise the whole thing begins to collapse.
Yeah. Well, eventually, though, you keep fooling Mother Nature and the whole thing will come apart, I think, Keith, in some way. And I don't know. I mean, so just in summing up then, what should people be doing? I mean, the equity market's going to, you think it's going to tank?
Yeah, I mean, asset prices, and especially let's look at equities and real estate, because they both have a perpetual component, you know, the income they produce is perpetual, essentially. And a house is rentable, and equity, in theory, produces profits, or at least, you know, dividends or something. And so if you try to figure out the net present value, this is, you know, classic securities analysis of, was it Benjamin Dodd and Graham and Dodd, right? Classic securities analysis, what is that cash flow worth discounted to the present? And you have to use the interest rate, which is the market interest rate. The higher the interest rate, the less it's worth in the present.
Right.
So they've jacked up interest rates enormously.
Right.
It was a lot of fun when interest rates were falling, because every halving of the interest rate doubles the net present value of the cash flows.
Right.
But on the way up, every doubling of the interest rate halves the net present value. So stocks and real estate have a long way they could potentially fall, except people are clinging to, comforting illusions, I guess. But the question is, will the Fed really be able to persist at this? Or will they be forced, as they were in 2008,
to
kind of slam interest rates back to zero? You know, this is probably my biggest deflationary argument, and that is there's essentially very soft demand for credit.
Yes.
Except when there's a downtick in interest.
Yeah.
Interesting to me, and I wrote about this in 2015, I think, when they were talking about hiking rates then, and right after when they did, and that is the car companies all offer 0% financing for really long periods of time, and they still are, by the way, even today. And in the wake of the 2015 hikes, I said, look at how much, this already was a subsidy that Ford and GM and everybody was offering. That subsidy was already costing them a lot of money. The increase in the cost of that subsidy through the course of those hikes was something like $1 billion to Ford, was my swag back in 2015 or 2016 when I wrote that. And now imagine how much that increase in that cost of that subsidy is even now. And the reason why the car companies are offering 0% financing even now is because it's a trade-off for them. If you try to charge the market rate of interest, sales volume will fall off a cliff.
Yeah.
No demand for the cars. And so you take whatever losses that would be, and you compare it to the losses of subsidizing the interest rate, and the losses from subsidizing the interest rate are smaller.
Yeah.
That is saying something very profound about the demand for credit. And right, in order for interest rates to rise and rise durably, there has to be somebody or groups of somebodies. The higher the interest rate goes, the more they're chasing it up and they want to borrow more, the more it's going up. That dynamic occurred in the 1970s.
Yes.
That's not happening now. Today. Right. It cannot. Everybody's too overleveraged. Everybody's too indebted.
Right.
Everybody's hanging on for dear life, because when all of their debts roll over at today's higher rates, most of them are probably dead.
Yeah.
So it's going to reverse. And the question is, how much crisis will, the Fed want to precipitate before they finally cry uncle? And, that's a political guess. So anybody's guess is fine.
It's a political guess for sure. So bottom line, Keith, then, what should people be doing with their money? I mean, obviously, you and I both agree, gold and silver bullion in your hands and have some of that. But beyond that.
So I was going to say, yeah, obviously, most people are not going to want to put even 50% or even 30% of their wealth into gold, let alone silver. It just seems crazy to them. So here's what I would say. For things that you think you may need for short-term liquidity purposes, I'd recommend T-bills. It's the obvious place to be. And by the way, the highest interest rates are on the short end of the yield curve anyway. So you're getting the best deal, I think, in the 6 months. I haven't looked at the shape of the yield curve in a few days, but I think it's the 6 month maturity gives you the highest yield. So put in, 1 month, 3 months, 6 months, T-bill, something like that.
Yeah.
For a bit of speculation, the longer bonds, although the interest rates have come down, which means the prices have rallied quite a bit. Right. But even right now, the 10-year is trading at 3.4%. I think it's pretty likely that pretty soon we're going to see 2.4% and then down. So for a bit of speculative kicker, 10-year treasury bonds or 30-year treasury bonds, for that matter,
right,
have a kicker to them.
Sure.
But the problem is, I don't see the problem being risk of hyperinflation imminently. Later is a whole different story. The problem is banking system risk.
Mm-hmm.
And people who were in Silicon Valley Bank thought they were safe. Moody's, until the day that they collapsed, thought they were safe. The California banking regulator said on Wednesday, 2 days before they collapsed and were utterly ruined, that it was safe and it was fine.
Yeah.
So if you have a banking system deposit, you have a risk to worry about that you didn't know that you needed to worry about 2 weeks ago, and suddenly now you need to be worrying about it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just the reality of the situation. And that's the argument, obviously, for gold. I remember when Cyprus, the banking system failed.
Right.
And I spoke to a bullion dealer there about the situation and what was he saying to people beforehand. And he kind of knew what was coming. And I said, folks, the point of owning gold, if you were in Cyprus back in, what was that, 2013 or something, I don't remember what year that was, wasn't that the price of gold was going to go up in euros. In fact, it didn't. If you look at that period of time, it wasn't rising. If anything, it was falling. The point of owning the gold was you weren't trapped in the banking system. So the banking system, seized up. You could no longer withdraw your money. It was a couple of weeks of bank holiday. Then they said 600 euros a day. If you had gold, you would just, and of course, unemployment at 40% or something on the island. If you had gold, you would just go to the harbor and you could pay for passage to the mainland where jobs, there were plenty of jobs on the mainland, and you could pay for the passage in gold. So it wasn't betting on the price going up. It was about the safety of owning gold versus owning the liability of an unsound banking system.
Mm-hmm.
And anybody who owned gold in Cyprus was happy that he did so. And not necessarily because he had more euros as a result of it, but because he still had his money. And I don't know if it was Mark Twain, I've been trying to find the source of this quote, who said, it's times like these that it's not about return on capital, it's about return off capital.
You're right.
And, can you get good rates and bank CDs right now and those sorts of things? Yeah, you probably can.
Yeah.
But is that a risk you want to play with?
Right. Well, right. All right, Keith, we'll have to leave it go at that. Thank you so much. I should tell people it's Monetary Metals, Monetary, I think, -metals.com, I saw. People can also get to your website through my own website, J. Taylor Media. We have a banner there that you can click on and it'll take you right to Monetary Metals. Keith, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. Your insight's always very valuable and appreciated.
Thanks for having me, Jay.
You bet. We'll look to do it again sometime if you're available.
Absolutely.
Okay. All right, folks. Well, before I say goodbye, I should mention that I expect to have Dr. Ewan Webster with me before the market opens on Thursday to discuss an important news release that that his company is putting out. And so you can check into the YouTube channel and hear what Ewan has to say. Also, if you enjoyed this video, hit the like button and sign up for our channel. Next Wednesday, I have David Stockman is scheduled to be with me, and perhaps Michael Oliver as well. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.